Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A Sacramento native, Sac State grad, Army veteran, and after 27 years with Sacramento Police, Kathy Lester will become the city's 46th police chief, the first woman to hold the position. Police Chief Daniel Hahn is retiring at the end of the year. Soon-to-be Chief Lester will lead a department of more than 1,000 sworn and civilian staff at a time when law enforcement faces hard scrutiny, protests in recent years demanding that the role of an officer elevates beyond policing, building trust with communities of color, and leading with transparency during controversial responses, especially when unarmed people die at the hands of law enforcement. Lester's announcement was received praise from city officials, including the mayor, but also criticism from those pushing for police reform, concern the promotion will just be more of the same. CAP Radio's Race and Equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan interviewed Deputy Chief Lester at length and joins us with that conversation. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, 27 years in the department, that is a long tenure, but likely an unfamiliar name to the public. Who is the incoming police chief?
Sure. Deputy Chief Kathy Lester is a longtime Sacramentan. As you mentioned, she served in the Army and then applied for a job as a dispatcher on the police force when she left active duty back in 1994. From there, she moved into the police academy and then into patrol. And most recently, she serves as Deputy Police Chief of Operations.
I think that many people have the perception that if you're a police officer, if you work for a department like us, you will work patrol and that's all you do. And there's so many great opportunities. I love patrol. It was really like the cornerstone of many of my assignments, but I've had the opportunity to work in investigations, in administrative assignments, do some really neat and unique things like working at the school district. And so when I talk to people about the job, it's an amazing place because you can stay here for 25 or 30 years, but it seems like, you know, I've worked very different jobs every few years.
Yeah, that's a lot of variety. Now, the headlines, of course, are leading with first woman, but is that significant to her?
Yeah, you know, I think Deputy Chief Lester actually expressed surprise at the fact that she is, in fact, the first woman to lead the department in over 100 years. But at the same time, she said she didn't think her gender would play a very big role in how she would choose to lead the force, which is, as some folks might know, currently 67% male. Here she is.
In the end, we're all police officers. We just have different roles and responsibilities. But thinking about what got me here, I'm really very excited and honored to talk about what the police department has done for me and what the city has done for its employees, because I've been here for 27 years now, and I know I wouldn't be in this position or moving into the position of chief of police had I have not had the right environmental conditions within the organization.
And Deputy Chief Lester has a pretty interesting perspective, not only 27 years with the police department and not only a Sac native, but her family goes back several generations here. How does that shape her view of Sacramento PD's role in the community?
Yeah, you know, I think Lester has a very strong belief in the leadership of outgoing Chief Daniel Hahn. From the way she put it, she would like to continue the work he's done, but she also understands that every police department has to continue to evolve.
Me being here is an example of how that has worked and what went right. And it didn't happen in the last year. It didn't happen in the last 10 years. It's been a whole career progression for me. So I, you know, in the end, I can't say that I just got here by myself, but I was certainly given some unique opportunities by a very supportive organization.
I think this statement in particular is actually a really powerful reflection on where Deputy Chief Lester is coming at the department from. She views her ascension, as you heard, to this role as an example of how the department has supported not just white men. And she believes that while the department has room to grow, it is an innately supportive space for all of those within.
And this announcement came about a week ago, and when it came out, she said that she wants to, quote, continue community-based policing. What exactly does that mean to her?
Ah, that is a good question. So she says right now she can't really provide specifics about her plans to continue community-based policing, as she isn't the chief yet, but she did say that connecting with the community is something she values, and she hoped all public organizations would continue to be open and accessible to the people they serve.
Well, as a race and equity journalist, Sarah, you've cultivated just important integral relationships with communities that are adversely impacted by law enforcement for generations, pushing for reform. How is this incoming police chief, Kathy Lester, being received by them?
Yes. So I would say many of the advocates I've spoken with are upset about the lack of transparency the city manager's office gave in selecting Lester as the new chief. I know many have also expressed concern over the fact that because she's a longtime veteran of the force and a true insider, she may not be open to changing things in ways that I think a lot of activists have been asking for over the past few months and even into last summer's demonstrations and before that. I also spoke with members of the city's police review commission who noted that they were not consulted about Lester's appointment, which I thought was interesting. Broadly, I'd say amongst the people who many of us saw and heard from during the Black Lives Matter demonstrations last summer, many just don't believe Lester's appointment is going to change much or get them much of the change they've been pushing for, unfortunately. And Lester's entering the police force not only during a time when a lot of folks are calling for police reforms, but she's also coming right after an independent audit found that Sacramento's police force disproportionately arrests and uses force on Black residents in particular. Here's her response to that survey.
Well, we've actually already started to do that. We've been doing that for many years. And I think that survey, which I was able to personally work on, we worked in partnership with the University of San Diego, as well as Sac State, is where you start, because you need to really know what the community thinks of you. And that study is based on a national survey that was done by Pew. And you'll see the results are similar at a national level. So it's not just a local issue that we have here in Sacramento, but it's a national one that we all need to work on as law enforcement collectively.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, sharing her conversation with the incoming Sacramento Police Chief, Kathy Lester. Well, that brings us to the 2018 deadly police shooting of Stephon Clark, who was unarmed in his grandmother's backyard. Lester was more than 20 years into the department. Did you talk about what happened?
Yes, we did. And I did mention that Lester was actually just beginning her time as deputy chief when Stephon Clark was murdered. She said she wasn't able to comment on that, but many advocates have said that the one point that they would feel some amount of justice or commitment to change from the Sacramento police force for this incident would be to fire the police officers who shot Clark. They are currently still a part of the Sacramento police force. Lester has said that she's heard the cries for change and that she does have some plans for leadership change in place come the new year, but she really couldn't expand upon that.
And firing officers or city employees is ultimately up to city manager Howard Chan. When talking with Police Chief Daniel Hahn, as well as other police chiefs in our area, about the issue of diversifying the police force so that it's ultimately reflective of the community that it serves, Lester will be the first female police chief in Sacramento, but she's white. How does she view diversity in the department?
As she mentioned earlier, she views her ascendance on the police force as evidence that the force is supportive of diversity. But you're right that though she's a woman, she's also white, something that Sacramento's police force is overwhelmingly, despite the fact that they serve an increasingly non-white city. She seemed to feel that the department was already working on diversity and that issues regarding lack of diversity on the force were mostly out of the control of the department. So things like the 2008 recession, where she said that took many of their lower ranking officers who were also more diverse out of the force. She also promises that newer cohorts of officers in training are also more diverse than the force currently reflects, but she didn't want to comment on how she might be able to use her position and positive experience of ascending through the force's ranks to help other women, or, you know, specifically when I think of women, I think of specifically women of color, helping them achieve her standing.
If you look back to when many organizations faced cuts during the Great Recession, we had to lay off our newest employees, and that was our most diverse group. And they, you know, like anyone would, went and found jobs in organizations where they had that opportunity. And so since that time, we have been working on trying to rebuild our department.
Chief Daniel Hahn also made strides towards transparency, releasing body cam footage, even welcoming audits of his own department. How will this continue, or will this continue with incoming Chief Lester? And if so, how?
I think there's the hope that this will continue. If anything, Lester was very supportive of Chief Hahn's time on the force and as its leader, and I believe she has every intention to keep many of the policies he has put into place already. City Manager Howard Chan mentioned that when they were looking for a candidate to continue the work that Chief Han did with the Sacramento Police Force, Lester was a, quote, perfect fit for the job. She has also mentioned that she's been involved with creating a transparency web page for the force where you can actually see statistics like police-related shootings and all of that. Here she is.
What I can tell you is that we are a transparent agency. I personally led the efforts and created our transparency webpage where you'll see a lot of information is contained. And the work that we've been doing through the Department of Justice, through a number of our outside partners, following best practices, including national best practices, is something that we are going to continue to do to ensure accountability for our department.
Last question, Sarah. After your conversation, what was your overall impression or sense of Deputy Chief Lester?
I believe that she is a traditional, she's a traditionalist in every sense of that word. After the upheaval that Sacramento saw last year and the way public opinion has turned with the Sacramento Police Force, I don't know if she was the city's most daring choice, but I do think she will keep the reforms that have currently been put in place. She has mentioned she will be making some leadership changes, as I said earlier, once she assumes the position of chief in the new year to address the results of that recent audit. But she said she also wasn't able to comment more than that at this time. She, I also hope that she will use her historic position as the force's first woman leader to really help other marginalized groups in the police department. She didn't really speak much about this, but women, and especially women of color, are a minority on SAC PD. But she, of course, when I spoke with her, she really stressed how she felt her success was a result of support directly from the department. So I really hope that she will consider that and kind of pay it back in a sense and really take this as her opportunity to support the success of other marginalized groups, particularly women of color, and to help them attain the level of support and career success that she herself has felt on the force.
Thanks for sharing that conversation, Sarah.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Vicki.
And that is CAP Radio Race and Equity reporter Sarah Mizestan sharing her interview with the incoming Sacramento Police Chief, Kathy Lester. Up next, did you know there's a snow lab at Donner Summit? The lead scientist joins us from 7,000 feet. Plus, how a possible link between Omicron and HIV is highlighting the importance of global vaccination against COVID. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Precipitation. Remember that? Well, we got a pretty good reminder of what it can do this week. On Monday, the National Weather Service reported that downtown Sacramento alone broke a daily rainfall record, 2.3 inches, the previous record set back more than a century ago in 1915. As of today, over 10 inches of rain and counting has fallen in Sacramento over the last 3 months. That's more than the entire 2020 water year, which ran from October of 2019 to September of 2020. And in the high country, it was pounded with long overdue snow. And it's still coming down in the Sierra, where the totals this week are being measured not in inches, but in feet. One person taking these precise snow measurements is a scientist perched at 7,000 feet and lives year-round on Donner Summit in an old, obscure cabin with his two dogs. His name is Dr. Andrew Schwartz, and he's the lead scientist at the UC Berkeley Central Snow Lab. Andrew joins us live from atop the summit with a unique perspective about California's snowpack. Welcome to Insight, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Vicki. I'm excited to be here.
You look pretty warm and cozy. I like your mug.
Yes, thank you. I brought a little bit of my Australian ocean up with me when I moved to the snow lab here in April.
Can you set the scene for us right now? What would it be like if we were to step outside the snow lab right now?
Oh, it's absolutely amazing for those of us that like snow. There's just massive amounts on everything. We've had about 6.5 feet just over that fall in the last week. In the last 24 hours, we've had 16 inches fall, and it's weighing down the trees. You've got that beautiful alpenglow at sunset and sunrise. It's a winter wonderland out there. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and it's really far from guaranteed given the last, few years that we've had. As a station manager, Andrew, you live year-round atop the mountain. You obviously love the snow. Where did your passion for snow and snowstorms come from?
It started at a really young age. I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and on rare occasions, we would get these big upslope snowstorms that would give you, you know, maybe 18 inches to 3 feet over the course of a couple days. And that was really when it developed. I just fell in love with snow and started, you know, really wanting to play out in it, and then decided to go to school for it and worked at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder for a little while, doing winter weather, and traveled to Australia to study their snow. And now I'm back up here. It's great. It's work, but I get to play in it nonstop. So
yeah,
it's also fun.
Can you describe the cabin where you do your research? And I guess, what was your first impression when you first arrived?
This cabin's been here since 1946. It was a joint project between the Army Corps of Engineers and the Weather Bureau, which is now the National Weather Service. It's got three bedrooms in it and a kitchen. Those three bedrooms at the time housed seven workers. Since then, the force has been scaled back to just me and a part-time employee, although we're hoping to expand. But yeah, it was interesting walking into the facility this last April, because it was brand new. It was wonderful to see everything. And, you know, it's kind of like that childlike excitement to see something anew. But at the same time, it smells like every scientific facility I've ever been in. So,
and what is that? Sterile, or I don't know. Hopefully, I don't know.
A little musky, a little dusty, but yeah, otherwise pretty good. But yeah, so a little bit of new, but a little bit of old too, I guess.
What does a day of a snow lab manager look like, and what information are you collecting?
So we're collecting, I'll start with what information we're collecting, but we're collecting every bit of information on snow once it's on the ground, when it's falling out of the sky. We're collecting all types of meteorological and climatological data as well. And we also test instrumentation here for a variety of people, whether that be companies or the Department of Water Resources. So we do, if it has to do with snow, we're probably working on it in one way or another. In terms of an average day, we do our measurements at 8 a.m. So I wake up bright and early, get online and start doing things, go out at 8 a.m., do a very technical measurement where you have a flat board and then you stick a ruler into the snow to see how much fell overnight. That's still, oddly enough, the best way to measure snowfall. So that's how it starts. We bring that in, put it in spreadsheets and put it online for everybody to find. And when we all do that measurement, we also measure the snow density or weight as well. And so that tells us how much water is in it, because you can have, you know, I'm sure everyone's familiar with the term Sierra cement, which is dense, thick, heavy snow. But you can also have that kind of champagne-y, powdery stuff that I was used to back in Colorado. And of course, water equivalent of the snow is incredibly important for being able to determine how well it's going to impact drought or what our water resources might be in the future.
Given that the snow lab was built in 1946, but am I correct, you actually have snow records dating back to the 1870s?
That's correct, yes. When the railroad came over the top of the pass here, they started doing snowfall records in 1879. So they started in 1879, and then when the snow lab up here was built in 1946, we developed our own records. And we've been continuing that until now. It's one of the longest snowpack and snowfall records in the world. And so it's one of the things that we kind of cherish ourselves on, and ran into a little bit of concern when the last lab manager retired, because we didn't necessarily have the ability to keep making those measurements. But luckily, a local ski patroller and author up here named Justin Lichter stepped up and kept those records going, because that's the last thing we want to do, is lose such an amazing data set like that.
Having really just that long view going more than a century, what does that tell us about California's snowpack, especially what we've been dealing with in the last several years?
Well, the longer period is definitely important. But what we really want to do is, you know, when we look at climatological averages, they're generally compared to 30-year periods. And so we have seen some significant trends that have come out of that that data set in both snowfall and snow depth. For instance, one of the things that we have seen is that our snowpack and our snowfall is decreasing, but our overall precipitation is increasing. So what that means is we're starting to see a lot more rain up here on the summit. And that's great unless you take into account that that can really melt our snow when rain falls on top of snow. And it can create issues like flooding or problems with water management where we might not be able to capture all of that for our uses. So that's one trend that we do see in that data set. And having that long, long period that we can look at everything really gives some solid credibility and support to the fact that we can see these trends in it.
Yeah, especially at a time of uncertainty with climate change. What is the black carbon? You analyze and test black carbon, and how does that impact the snow melt?
Right, so black carbon, we don't do a whole lot of that at the lab currently. It's something the lab's done in the past. But my personal work and my PhD research was focused on how wildfires impact snow. Generally, they're not happening at the same time, so it's not like the fire's melting the snow, of course. But when that fire comes through and darkens the tree trunks and darkens the surrounding plants with that kind of char on them, that can fall off and fall on top of the snow, which makes it dark. And of course, if you've worn a black t-shirt on a hot summer day, that's going to mean that your snowpack is reacting the same way your t-shirt would and absorb a lot more of that heat. And as a result, in these wildfire burned areas, we do see a lot faster melt and lower snowpack than in some areas that may not be burned. And so that black carbon that sits on the top of the snowpack really affects the speed at which that happens and can actually contaminate our water resources a little bit too following fire.
Wow. I mean, that's just fascinating. Before we let you go, Dr. Schwartz, year round at the summit, it is snowing. You love snow. Where do you go on vacation? Like a tropical island, maybe some warmer temperatures?
That's a really good question. I just spent 4 years living in subtropical Australia, so that was kind of a vacation in itself. But I would be thinking that Hawaii is sounding pretty good at this point, somewhere on the beach with a good fruity drink and just relaxing.
You deserve it. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you for having me, Vicky. You have a good day.
You too. That is Dr. Andrew Schwartz, the lead scientist at the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab, speaking to us from atop Donner Summit about this week's snowfall and perspective on the future of snow in the Sierra. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. As we learn more about the health implications of the Omicron variant, scientists are working to unlock the mystery of the variant's origins. A theory which has gained momentum is a possible connection with another virus, which has taken the lives of 36 people since it started circling the globe, HIV and AIDS. Infectious disease researchers at Stanford University helped strengthen this possible link, following what they found in a 61-year-old Bay Area patient. Here to share what they found is Dr. Seth Hoffman, an infectious disease fellow at Stanford Healthcare, who treated the patient in the hospital. Dr. Hoffman, welcome to Insight, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You treated this patient in the hospital. What did you discover?
Yeah, so this patient came in untreated HIV/AIDS, which resulted in her immune system being weakened. And because of a history of having had COVID several weeks prior, I was interested to find out, hey, has she been having an ongoing infection, which is overall rare, but when people have ongoing infections, they might be at risk for developing mutations, which occur when the reproductive machinery of the virus makes errors. And so the longer one has an active infection, the greater risk of developing a concerning mutation. And so I contacted the head of the virology department here, and we sequenced the virus that she had on her first day, and then about 2 weeks later, 15 days. And we noted that there were quite a few somewhat alarming mutations that had developed in such a short period of time.
when compared to someone who isn't severely immunocompromised?
So it's really just a risk-based time during which somebody is infected. And so somebody who is not immunocompromised has a shorter length of active infection and thus a shorter time period where the reproductive machinery can make these errors. So certainly people who have normal immune systems can develop a mutation whilst they have infection, but people who have immunocompromised immune systems, they're at risk for these longer infections. Not all immunocompromised patients, but more often than people who have functioning immune systems. And that time of prolonged infection just increases risk.
Was the patient vaccinated?
Around this time was when vaccines were rolling out to healthcare workers. So at that time, no. Because this was, she developed her infection late 2019 into, oh no, I'm sorry, late 2020 into 21.
Mm-hmm, right.
So not quite available to the general public at that time.
You know, you really highlight the fact that it was untreated HIV. What happened to the patient after they were treated with treatments for the virus?
Absolutely. Yeah. So what's awesome is that the treatments available today for HIV are so fantastic, so effective, and work so fast. So really rapidly after we started our patient on treatment for her HIV, her immune system kicked into action, battled off the infection, cleared the infection. And, you know, once there's no infection going on, you're not at risk for those mutations to occur because the machinery is not reproducing virus.
Is Stanford the only research institution looking into this possible link, or are there other ones? I mean, I think I read something like from South Africa as well, correct?
So I would say that probably globally, most research institutions are aware of the risk that immunocompromised patients can have. You know, the CDC, I think maybe really early on in 2021 or even before that, actually, in late 2020, there were research reports about cancer patients who were on chemotherapies that weakened their immune systems, who had prolonged infections with SARS-CoV-2, and that were shown to develop mutations over those times. And so I think a lot of research institutions are looking at this, whether it's cancer patients, organ transplant mm-hmm. patients, people with autoimmune conditions, or persons living with HIV/AIDS, not on treatment. I think this is a well-recognized phenomenon, and it just so happens that the scientist who alerted the world to the Omicron variant happened to come from Southern Africa, and it just so happens there is a large population of persons living with HIV in Southern Africa, and so that association has been brought up. It's not definitive that Omicron came from a person living with HIV/AIDS, not on treatment. Could be any kind of immunocompromised person, or just a normal person where the SARS-CoV-2 virus is just running rampant in a community, that it can pick up mutations that way as well.
Especially raising the fact that, especially in Africa, I think currently less than 8% of the continent is vaccinated against COVID-19. So what does this tell us when it comes to global vaccine equity as well as HIV treatment?
Yeah, so I think there are two points that this case, this patient we had the privilege to care for at Stanford brings up as it relates to underserved populations globally and the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. To answer your primary question, which is about global vaccine equity, even if we think about the immunocompromised patients we have here in the United States, the best thing that we can do is prevent infections in these persons. And so that's doing the things we already know. That's wearing masks, getting vaccinated, which reduces the risk of transmission, and also makes infection more mild. And then, you know, when appropriate, social distancing. However, globally, if we don't make it so that our global community has equal access to these vaccines that are so beneficial, then we're gonna keep repeating ourselves here. You know, likely Omicron developed in an area where there was lower vaccine coverage, and the more vaccine coverage we have, even though we have seen that people are getting infections who are fully vaccinated, even people who have received a third dose, it sounds like the preliminary evidence on Omicron is that those persons have a much more mild infection. Mm-hmm. But the number one thing we can do is get the vaccine out to the global community. You know, we're deep into this pandemic already, and it sounds like we're going to just keep repeating ourselves, and we'll kick ourselves for looking back and seeing we need to do more on the vaccine equity. And I just want to make a point in terms of global health equity. You know, the HIV/AIDS epidemic is ongoing, and so we have this really cool opportunity. Persons who are historically underserved and not recognized by general society in terms of populations living with HIV/AIDS, we need to do more about reducing the stigma associated with HIV/AIDS, getting accessible testing and getting treatment out there, because that reduces the risk those people have to potentially have ongoing SARS-CoV-2 infection. And then, of course, people who are on HIV treatment live full lives. This is a wonderful treatment that works super well.
Before we let you go, Seth, what has been the most surprising aspect to someone who studies infectious diseases about COVID as you've watched it evolve and spread?
I think probably maybe this is not surprising, but the interaction this virus has had with global society, and perhaps we knew all along how we needed to handle this and we just haven't made it work. And hopefully this pandemic, because of the way Mother Nature works, is likely we'll have other pandemics in potentially the not so distant future with other viruses. If we can come together and be a better global community for our society, for underserved populations, for people living with HIV/AIDS, we can come out of this really prepared for the next pandemic and better, just better human beings to one another.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of painful, hard lessons from this pandemic. Dr. Seth Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Vicki. Have a great day and stay safe out there.
You too. He is an infectious disease fellow at Stanford Healthcare, sharing research on the Omicron variant and its possible connection to the HIV virus. Still ahead, three words, jingle bell jazz. The Cap Radio tradition returns this season. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It's been a Cap Radio tradition for 40 years, and hopefully it's been a tradition in your home as well. We're talking about Jingle Bell Jazz, Cap Radio's Christmas Eve program, celebrating the holiday season with cool sounds. Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, started the program 4 decades ago, and we're happy to announce that you can hear Jingle Bell Jazz once again next Friday night, Christmas Eve. This year, though, we're giving Gary the night off. Taking the seat in the music chair will be Cap Radio jazz host Andrew Mills, but Gary's fingerprints are still all over the show. Andrew and Gary join us now. Welcome to Insight. This is a great way to end our final live segment of the year.
Thank you. It absolutely is. And it's a pleasure to be here and talk about it and get everybody excited.
Hey, Gary. Andrew,
hi.
Starting with you, you're going to be sitting in the chair next Friday night, Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. Do you want to share with us a little bit about how Jingle Bell Jazz got its start?
I do. I did a little bit of research and talked to Gary a bit and put together this little piece that I think illustrates pretty accurately how it all went down. So let's hear it.
'Twas the 23rd of December, 20 years ago, and Gary Vercelli had no Christmas Eve show. Bitter he was for working this day, Gary said to himself,
"Who cares what I play?"
Walking home among the trees on this cold and damp night, Gary stopped at Tower Records, where he was met with a fright. Not a Kenny G record, which is what he feared most. No, before him stood tall, a jazz radio ghost.
"What say you?"
cried Gary, his will undeterred.
"What have you to say that I've not already heard?"
"Three spirits will visit this penultimate eve. Jennifer, Kevin, and a third one called Steve. But their names matter not, for it's a warning they bring of Christmas Eve, jazz, bossa nova, and swing."
With that, the ghost vanished. Not a trace left in sight. Gary went home to his bed and promptly turned out the light. At the stroke of 3, he awoke as if he'd not slept at all, and there 3 figures were at his back bedroom wall. 2 of them were arguing at the left and right of his room, and a third saying nothing, but in the darkness it loomed.
"Jazz is tradition. The past can't be forgotten. Armstrong and Basie, without them, jazz is rotten."
"But it's the present that matters. Veronica Swift, she's the greatest. For jazz to move forward, we must hear the latest."
Gary listened to this with naught but dismay.
"See what I mean? Who cares what I play?"
The third spirit rose and said not a word. It simply pointed to a future, one without a sound to be heard. Then in Gary's heart, a new idea flickered. It came to him suddenly, as the other two bickered.
"This music is for all, present, future, and past. So each Christmas Eve, I'll play Jingle Bell Jazz."
All right, Andrew, when did the wheels start turning for this? That was such a treat.
It's all true, too.
It's all true. I like the Tower Records mention.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Gary, you gave up so many Christmas Eves to be with your listeners. How did you come about with the concept of Jingle Bell Jazz, 4 decades ago?
Well, listening to Herb Wong on the 24-hour commercial jazz station, K-Jazz, in the Bay Area, he had a tradition of playing a lot of great Christmas jazz. So I sort of extrapolated from that. Having been a waiter and a disc jockey all my life, I've never minded working holidays, to set the record straight. So it's been a lot of fun. But Andrew volunteered this year and I said, "Hey, yeah, I'll take a little trip and have fun with it."
What are you going to do Christmas Eve, Gary?
I'm actually traveling down to Santa Barbara. So I don't know if it'll be raining down there, but rain or shine, it's always a pleasure to be in that part of the state.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area. Okay, Andrew, let's get into some of the music listeners are going to hear part of Jingle Bell Jazz's 4-hour program next Friday night. How did you go about curating this?
Well, I mean, of course, our listeners are going to hear some of the timeless classics, like you're going to hear a certain Christmas song by Nat King Cole. But every year, musicians make new Christmas albums and holiday albums, and some of them are really great, including this first clip from Jeff Hamilton. He's a drummer, a well-renowned drummer, and his trio highlighted by pianist Tamir Hendelman. And this is a song everybody will know, but I think there's a nice, fresh take on it that you might like, and I hope you do.
Here comes Santa Claus. That is awesome. Next song, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Talk to us about this rendition.
Well, this is from guitarist Pat Martino, who we sadly lost this year. An iconic guitarist with an incredible story. He started his career in the 60s, but then suffered a brain aneurysm in 1980 where he forgot completely how to play guitar.
Wow.
And had to teach himself again by listening to himself. It's an incredible story, and he really, it's an inspiring career,
yeah,
to be
absolutely.
Sure. So this is a cool rendition, again, of a song we all know. So check it out.
I envision myself cozying up with a cup of hot cocoa.
Yeah, it's a beautiful tone that he had, and it's just a lovely recording of a wonderful Christmas tune that we all love.
The next one, Norah Jones. I love her voice. Tell us about this song.
Yes, we all know Norah Jones, a big star, to be sure. But this album, I Dream of Christmas, just out this year, is her first holiday album, if you can believe that,
wow.
A person like that. And what's cool about this, it has some well-known tunes on it, but it's a lot of originals. And this one called Christmas Time, I really like it, and I hope you do too. It's an original that Norah wrote, so.
Can you believe it's Christmas time? Sometimes the joy is hard to find.
What a wonderful trajectory she's had, and, yeah. And also a good message with this song.
Absolutely, and a very Norah Jonesian Christmas, to be sure.
Yes. The last one is A Good Swing Wenceslas. You got to do that for
good
me.
Good Swing Wenceslas.
There,
good Swing
thank
Wenceslas.
You.
It's a swing rendition of Good King Wenceslas, you know, a classic holiday tune. But the Count Basie Orchestra, very famous, of course, and since Count Basie's death in the 80s, the band has gone on under different leadership. But this tune was arranged by Sammy Nestico, who we also lost this year, and he's really the guy behind so many of the arrangements of classic Count Basie tunes. So I thought it was fitting to do something that he arranged.
You know it's a good selection when all the heads are bobbing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's Sammy Nestico sound with Count Basie Orchestra. It's classic.
Ending on a strong note. So tell us once again, when can listeners listen to Jingle Bell Jazz?
Christmas Eve, December 24th, 7 p.m. I'll be on live and almost certainly alone in the studio. Maybe the spirits will come visit me. Who knows?
Well, I am sure lots of people will be keeping you company from their homes and cars listening. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Pleasure.
That is Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, handing off the torch to Cap Radio jazz host Andrew Mills, giving us a taste of the annual Cap Radio music tradition, Jingle Bell Jazz, next Friday night, Christmas Eve. That is it for Insight today. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian, our digital team Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director, Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Next week, we have a special set of shows looking back at some of the most impactful conversations of the year, and then we're off the final week of 2021. We leave you with Gary Vercelli and Gary Porter reminiscing about the spirit of the holiday season.
What does Christmas mean to Gregory Porter?
Definitely, it means family and just trying to find a way to express your love and appreciation for them. For me, Christmas has always been this really powerful time. Even in the absence of something, maybe if your father is not around or if a parent has passed away or something like that, even that aspect of Christmas is a really powerful time for remembering loved ones. So it's a big deal for me, and I'm sure a bunch of people will be coming over to the house, and I'll be cooking away and pouring all sorts of warm and delightful libations, you know, whatever come with me, but I'm looking forward to it.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. And tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas to you.